The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
This morning I'd like to offer you the teachings from a particular discourse of the Buddha, which is the way that the discourses of the Buddha are organized, is the very first discourse. And it doesn't have the same kind of prominence as like Genesis in the Bible being in the beginning. But it has some meaning that the way the early discourses are organized, this is the first one. And it's has some prominence in terms of its importance. And as an introduction to it, I want to say that something about how the Buddha often switches or transforms the emphasis on, or the frame with which to understand religious teachings of his time. And one example of this is that in the time of the Buddha, there were certain people who felt that prominent religious figures, people who are fully realized, enlightened or something, should be omniscient. And in some other religions, it's, God who's omniscient, some people think. The idea of omniscience and his high powers are important. And so there were people at the time of the Buddha who expected someone like, if the Buddha was really as prominent, as important as people wanted him to be, then certainly he must have been omniscient. So rather than saying, no, I'm not omniscient, the Buddha said, yeah, I'm omniscient. Basically said, yeah, I'm omniscient. That's nice, isn't it? And I'll tell you how I'm omniscient. And then being omniscient means to understand everything, right? So in his environment, that meant to understand the past, the future, whatever is going on over the world at the same time, right? So the Buddha said, I'm omniscient, and this is how I'm omniscient. Nothing whatsoever, there's nothing whatsoever in the world, in the universe, past, present, and future, that is worth clinging to. Right? So he knows one thing about everything. And that makes him omniscient. Isn't that quite something? So now if you want the Buddha, your Buddha, to be omniscient, you can say, yeah, he's a great guy, he knew everything. He knew that, but what he knows about everything is nothing whatsoever, that stuff is worth clinging to. And so it kind of reframes the situation. And this discourse that I'm going to talk to you about is one of the primary issues that addressed here is how people relate to religious views, doctrines. And so here also there's a kind of reframing of the issue. And one way that, before I go into the discourse, I'll offer you something I've learned in being a teacher, is that sometimes people will come here to IMC or to me with very profound or very important religious questions, existential questions about life, that make sense sometimes to ask. Especially in a Buddhist context, they might ask, what is the Buddha, what does Buddhism teach about rebirth? And what I've learned is that more often than not, if I give a detailed explanation about the Buddhist teachings on rebirth, that the person who asked begins to kind of look glazed. And they begin kind of like, I feel like I'm, they're kind of lost them. And so what I've discovered is that what's much more interesting to ask is to ask a question back. So why are you asking about rebirth? And then more often than not, what comes back is the person will say, my dear uncle just died. Someone in my family just died, or I'm just got a diagnosis and I only have a few more months or something. And in the context of that kind of existential life issue, they don't want a detailed dissertation with footnotes from me about what Buddhism has to say about rebirth. Right? That's not what the issue is. The issue is they're grappling with these personal issues. And so then, once we find out that their favorite uncle has just died, or they're dying, then there's a whole other way of meeting that person and having a conversation. So what's motivating them is more interesting. And as you, I think we know, it's sometimes, you know, it's almost sometimes, it's so common in therapy that sometimes, you know, the people will joke on it, is that it's very common someone will come to a therapist with a great, important story of their life and tell the story and tell the story and tell the story and tell the story, goes on. And at some point, a therapist might ask, well, how do you feel about that? Or how do you feel about telling me the story? And they're reframing it and refocusing the attention to something other than who's to blame or what happened, to something which is maybe can be discovered here and now in their own experience, how they feel, what the emotions, what's motivating to tell the story, what's happening. And then we have a whole different conversation. It opens up in a different way. And this happens in meditation almost naturally, that if the focus on meditation is to keep coming back here to yourself, to your own personal experience, it's hard to sustain the rumination of telling stories, past and future. And so, but rather because you keep coming back here, you start discovering what's here, the feelings, the motivations, the ideas, all this. And if the dedication is just to sit and be present with that immediate stuff, something begins slowly to shift. There's a letting go, a relaxing, a settling into it, unwinding of some of the tension and agitation connected to the stories and ideas and all this we're having. And it's quite powerful to sit regularly, sit and meditate in a consistent, regular, ongoing way, because the benefits from that are sometimes not seen or known if all you do is sit and meditate at once in a great while. The consistency and the regularity of sitting allows us to kind of begin tapping into, touching into the deeper structures of our thinking, our emotional life, the way we hold on to things. And as we tap into it, and we meditate, it begins to relax and to soften. This dissolving of what's happening. And so, for example, the criticism sometimes, it's very occasionally people might make of a meditator, is that it's just another self-help project. More conceit, more building up and strengthening self. Occasionally that's true. It's hard in these Buddhist circles to distinguish narcissism from healthy, you know, mindfulness. And conceit, arrogance, self-importance, self-focus in the kind of the wrong way comes with tension and agitation. And if we're sitting upright and still, and as the tension and agitation falls away, the conceit falls away as well. You don't have to solve the conceit. You sit with it and it dissolves, it relaxes. That makes sense, what I'm saying? So here we're seeing a shift, right? So rather than focusing on the story, we can focus on something that's more primary and immediate, and as a whole, it becomes a different event, different kind of unfolding that goes on. So in this discourse, it's called the Brahma-Jala discourse. It's Brahma means kind of like the divine, for now, for the time being. Divine net, discourse on the divine net. And partly why it's called a net is that you'll see it says that all views, all religious doctrines, all existential doctrines that people have can fit into 62 different views. And I'm not going to list them all to you. So you can stay relaxed and open. But 60, and I don't know if it's true where they all can fit into them. Maybe it has to do with the time of the Buddha. But it's possible to kind of go into these slowly, these 62 views, and discover that there's a strong connection to these, to the stories that many of us tell ourselves about ourselves and our life. You don't have to have religious doctrines, to have deeper assumptions that you're operating on about what it means to be a person, what it means to be a person in relationship to other people, in relationship to the future, the past, and that these views, expressed in kind of religious ways, touch on to, I think, deep underlying identity issues that maybe, and ideas about the world that many of us operate on anyway, even if we're not religious. So the discourse begins with the Buddha is out wandering around on tour, wandering around northern India, and travels with a few other monks. And there was a time in India where there were many ascetics, apparently, many wanderer seekers who would wander around seeking and practicing. And as probably happened often enough, some of them were walking on the same road and kind of, you know, walked side by side. And there was an ascetic, of a seeker of a different sect, different religion, a teacher and his disciple, who ended up walking with or behind, right behind the Buddha and his monks for a number of days. And as they were walking, kind of together, the teacher and his disciple were having a disagreement, an argument. And one of the ways to be very disrespectful of your teacher in India, generally, I don't know about ancient India, but probably then, is to argue with your teacher. It's okay to argue here with me. Manerika, this is whole, you know, some of you are too eager. But it's okay here. But in the different cultures, it's a big deal. So, and what they were arguing was, it doesn't say the details, but the teacher, this other teacher, is disparaging the Buddha. And the disciple is praising the Buddha. So this goes on for a number of days. And the Buddha's monks hear all this. And so they're in camp one day, you know, at night, and they're discussing this. And in their discussion, the monks offer their own praise of the Buddha. So they offer, you know, rather and they specify what they praise him for. And this is where the text begins to do the switch into, away from what we usually would think is what's important, to a whole different orientation or look at what may be important. And so here, what the monks are praising the Buddha for is the Buddha understands or sees. It says sees and clearly distinguishes between the different mental tendencies of people, the different inclinations, the different dispositions, the different resolves, the kind of assumptions that the minds operate on. So rather than praising the Buddha that he understands the fundamental truths of reality, he understands the highest reaches of cosmic consciousness, or something grand and ultimate, that his monks praise him for understanding how people in their minds operate in terms of their inclination, their dispositions. I think this is very significant, right? It's a beginning of. They go to the Buddha, or the Buddha ends up in conversation with his monks, and hears they're concerned about these others who are criticizing him or praising him. And the Buddha gives his first teaching. And to the degree to which we're familiar with a blasphemy being an issue in religious circles, that, you know, people get angry if your religion is criticized. It's very interesting. The very first teachings in the discourses of the Buddha, first one in the way it's organized, the Buddha is offering teachings that relate to the issue, at least the modern issue of blasphemy. He says, don't be upset. Don't be angry if people criticize the Dharma or the Buddha. Because if you get angry, you won't be able to see the truth. It'll obscure your ability to understand deeply. but rather stay relaxed and calm. And if it's a matter-of-fact thing, you can point out how someone doesn't understand and explain to them what the truth is or how it is here. And if someone praises you, don't get elated. But if it's not true what they're saying, point out how it's not true. And if it is true, then I forget what it says. Just that's okay. So I find it kind of nice that Buddha's offering his first teachings. Don't get caught up if people criticize, disparage, or even praise the Dharma. That's not the point of all this. You're not supposed to be connected to this great. Importantly, being connected to great and true teachings, it's not worth getting too excited about. So that's interesting, too. I mean, most religions don't begin that way. So again, it's something a little different is going on here in this text than what sometimes we expect. So then the Buddha says, well, most people, ordinary people, will praise the Buddha, praise me, for my ethics. And they'll praise me for these kinds of things that I do. I don't kill, I don't steal, I don't lie, I don't involve in slander and gossip, I don't, I'm not covetousness, I don't have greed, I don't have anger. And he lists a variety of things which can be seen as kind of basic morality. They praise me for that. And the Buddha says, well, when people praise me for being this way, and he is this way, he's a very moral person, the Buddha says, these are trifling things to praise me for. These don't, minor things. And then, and some people will praise me because I also follow the ethical standards for how the renunciants of his time would live. Renunciants who received food from the faithful, food because they go for alms, they only eat what people give them. So they have a different standard of behavior expected, professional standards of being an ascetic, that they're supposed to kind of live by. A little bit more renunciant and very right. And he says, I also live this way, but these are minor things, trifling. And then he goes, finally, he says, and there's other ethical ways that which people I can be praised for. In terms of making my livelihood, how I, receive alms and a way of living, there's a number of things other ascetics do, which are, he calls them kind of base arts. So like predicting the future, predicting lottery numbers, things in that category of things. And so I don't do those things. And not doing those things, this is minor praise. This is nothing. So what he does here, the Buddha establishes, first of all, that his ethical life, he's very ethical. And, it's kind of goes on and on, page after page of all the ethics. It's kind of long and boring. But it's establishing that he lives by a very high ethical standard. So it's very important. There's no doubt about that. No doubt about his purity of his ethics. But it's a mere trifling thing. It's not what you should praise the Buddha for. So what should a Buddha be praised for? The Buddha goes on. So he says, these all ethical things are minor, trifical ethical behavior for which worldlings, ordinary people, would praise the Buddha. Then he goes on, there are other matters, profound, hard to see, hard to understand, peaceful, beyond mere reasoning, subtle, to be experienced by the wise, which I have realized by my direct knowledge, and which I teach. about which it would be one could truthfully praise me. So, there are things that the Buddha says it's worthwhile praising me for. And he's not going to say what they are yet, but he says, but this is kind of characterizes them. They're certainly profound. They're hard to see this. Ordinary people can't see this very well. But they're connected to peacefulness. And they're not connected to reasoning. It's not something you think out. And it's something to be experienced by the wise. So experience something you do in the present moment. And something involves direct knowledge, direct penetration. So what is this? So then he goes on and he describes 62 common views that existed, I guess, in his time, religious views, doctrines, positions that people held, that had to do with things like the nature of the self, of consciousness, what happens after death, is there some kind of continuity, the nature of the universe, the world, is it permanent, is it infinite, is it impermanent, is it bounded, is it kind of finite, or is it infinite and measureless and boundless, this universe that we live in? Was there a creator of this universe? And then he gives a fascinating story about how there was a mistake made, a misunderstanding, how the misunderstanding arose that the great Indian god Brahma came to think that he was the creator of the universe, of the world. So that's kind of an interesting story. You know, it's not like the, you know, the Western god of the Western world. So we don't know how he came to his understanding that he was creator of the world, the universe. You know, maybe some misunderstanding, maybe not a misunderstanding. Who knows how he came to that understanding? But anyway, Buddha said the Brahma, the creator god of that ancient Indian world, that misunderstood it. You want to hear how this misunderstanding arose? This is good for meditators to hear, because partly these things arose as a misinterpretation of a certain kind of meditative experience that someone had. So in this ancient cosmology of India, they kind of had the yo-yo theory of the universe. The yo-yo, you have the Big Bang theory, we know that these days, that there was a teeny little dot. You couldn't see, you needed a magnifying glass to see it. And boom, you know, it exploded. And we're part of this explosion, right? We're just hurling through space at hundreds of thousands of miles an hour. And we're still kind of like, you know, part of this Big Bang. I mean, it's like, put on your helmet and seatbelt, because it's still kind of, and we're not coming back. That's the latest theory. We're not going back. You know, it's like we're going out and out and out. It's amazing speed. I wish there was a speed limit, but it's going fast, you know. Hundreds of thousands of miles an hour we're traveling. But one theory for a while in cosmology was that this, at some point, the gravitational force of all the stars and all the matter would pull everything back in together again, and everything would collapse back into this singularity, this dot. And then it would explode again. And so it was a yo-yo theory. Well, this was kind of the theory of ancient India, that there was expansion and contraction. And when everything gets totally contracted, one of those extremes, I forget which one, there's no more physical beings. There's just this kind of like floating up at a very high, ethereal, heavenly realm beyond the world somehow. Consciousness just kind of like hangs out in a disembodied way. And at some point, the world begins to come back into formation. And before the physical world comes back, the lower heavenly realms come into being. And when one of the things that apparently just happens, the way this universe is created, is that Brahma's palace gets created. And then at some point in this heavenly disembodied consciousness kind of ethereal realm, one of the beings there runs out of his lifetime. Because lifetimes are always finite. Dies up there and happens to get reborn in Brahma's palace, this palace that just appeared. He looks around. There's no one there. And after a while, he says, you know, it's kind of lonely here. It would be nice if there were other people here too. Coincidentally, when he had that thought, someone else died in the ethereal realms and got reborn there also. And he thought, oh, look, wow. I just had that thought. I must have created that person. And that person who got appeared after Brahma said, oh, he's always been there. And he thinks he's responsible for me. He's the creator. And at some point, Brahma has a really long lifetime as Brahma, has a longer lifetime than that second person who came. So that second person at some point died in this Brahma heavens and was born as a human and then meditated. And in meditation, remembered his past life in the realms of Brahma. And remember, oh yeah, he was there first. He said that he created me. Yes, it must be that Brahma is ultimate, is permanent, is eternal, created the universe. And then he went around, I guess, and started teaching other people, Brahma created the universe. So that's quite an interesting interpretation of the creator God thing. It was all a misunderstanding. And so those kinds of issues. So here's an issue about the creator God, about rebirth, the nature of the universe, of self, very important. A lot of different things. And including, it ends with five different theories or views about the nature of nirvana, of liberation. You think that nirvana is like the goal of the early Buddhists, right? And so there's a number of, apparently it was something that other people at the time were searching for, and they had ideas of what nirvana is. So the Buddha doesn't criticize any of these views exactly, except maybe the Brahma thing seems like it gets criticized. He mostly describes how these things are, these appear. And then you'd think that maybe then he would offer his views. After I've told you all these views, now I'm going to tell you my doctrine, the real truth, the 63rd view. But he doesn't do that, or doesn't do it in the normal way. Again, here we have the switch that I talked about earlier, the reframing it and looking at the whole thing in a different way. Remember, early on, the monks were praising the Buddha that he could see the dispositions, the mental tendencies of people. So the Buddha says, now, this is what I understand. So he said all these things, and this is what my understanding is. So you're poised, ready for his doctrine. But this is what he says. These 62 doctrines, 62 points of view, if they're grasped and attached to, lead to bad results. If they're attached to, lead to bad results. The point is not, are they true or false, but rather, are we attached to them? Do we cling to them? That's his emphasis. This is the reframing. Rather than engaging them at their own kind of doctrinal level, what's true and false, he's focusing on what is the attachment? Is there attachment? This is what I know. And even more so, I am not attached to knowing that even. And being unattached, I experience peace. So there's something about, so the reframing has to do with the attachment and clinging to use. So this, I think this is a great challenge to many of us. Many of us have stories that we live our lives by. Some of them are philosophical or religious. Some of them are personal, very, you know, just kind of ordinary, you know, stories that are things happen to us, our interpretations of what happened to us. And the reframing is not to engage in the story by itself, the truth and false of it, but what is our relationship to the story, to the doctrine? Are we attached or not? And again, in a world of people, a world where blasphemy and world where religious views carry tremendous currency of what's true and false, and it's a radical thing to suggest, let's look at the attachments we have to them, the clinging we have, as opposed to the views themselves. And one of the reasons for that, I think it's very significant, is that it's the attached, just like the Buddha said earlier, if you get angry at people criticizing the Dharma, you won't see clearly. If you're attached to your stories and views, chances are through that attachment you won't see clearly. So look at the attachment. And this is again something a meditation can help a lot with. There's something about the experiential, visceral experience of it, clinging and attachment, that can stand out in meditation better than almost any other place. And we can take some responsibility for it and deal with it. And then the Buddha goes on to say that he also understands or sees the arising and passing of feelings. The arising and passing of, and feelings here probably means the basic sense data from which we build our universe. So yeah, it has to start somewhere, right? Before we have abstract ideas, we have to have some immediate contact with the world. And if we go back to the basic raw experience, we build abstractions and abstract ideas from, what do we see? What's the very foundational basis? What's the building blocks that we build abstract theories? And here, this basic building block of feeling, or the basic immediate present moment experience. I truly understand the arising and passing of these feelings, these basic raw building blocks. I understand the attraction, the benefit, what's good about them, and I understand the danger that's there as well. And I understand how to be free of those things. So if, for example, I find ice cream tasty. It's nice, right? And I have a philosophy about ice cream, that my life would be a lot happier if I could have ice cream breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And because of the danger of getting tired, it should be different. One flavor, I should have changed the flavor. And that's really the solution for happiness. But if I go back and look at the sense data that I'm building this philosophy of ice cream on, and realize it's built on the pleasure that arises from having the ice cream. But then I ask myself the question, what's the attraction, and what's the benefits, and what's the danger of this ice cream thing? Well, the benefit, it's pleasant, it's refreshing, it's joyful, it's whatever. It's many things it can be good for. It's meaningful. I go with my kid, little kids. Sometimes we used to go weekly to get ice cream. It was like a family ritual. It's a benefit to kind of bond the family. Once a week we would get ice cream. So it has its benefits, this whole ice cream thing. What's the danger? And I suspect that more than just a few of you have discovered in your own direct experience the danger of ice cream. I would be hard-pressed to believe that there's a lot of you here who somehow in the course of your lifetime haven't run into problems You know, we're privileged here. It's relatively easy to get ice cream for most of us. But like for me, you know, when I was one of the dangers I had of, I decided that I should try to get an ice cream that had 5 scoops of ice cream on one cone. I was 14. And the danger of that was that just as I left the ice cream, they didn't want to give it to me, but they did. And as I was leaving the store, just outside on the sidewalk, the cone broke. Or we get sick or something, right? We get just nauseous or something. So there are dangers, right? And then and then we can understand how to be free of those dangers. How free, not get caught and attached in the sense pleasure and all the issues that can arise, right? So this is a silly, maybe trifling example, but in many ways this builds into even the most profound issues in our lives. So this the Buddha understands, and this is how the Buddha is liberated. So he's not offering a different view. He's offering an understanding about attachments, about what about the world that we live in, how we relate to it, and how to relate it to it in such a way that we don't suffer. And the key of this has to do with attachment. And then he makes a radical statement. He says, these ascetics and Brahmins who have all these 62 ultimate views about reality, those views are merely the feelings of those who do not see, know and see. They're just feelings. They're just kind of based on, you know, on their own direct kind of feeling of how things should be. And they're connected to the agitation and vacillation, to the worry and vacillation of those immersed in craving. So that's a little bit critical of them, because I don't know if that's really true, that people have these 62 views are involved in craving. But that's the emphasis of the Buddha here, is not whether the views are true or false, but what's the relationship we have to them. And he's saying these people have craving attached to them. So what happens if you overcome the craving as opposed to, you know, what happens to the views, your relationship to them? And then he ends by saying, whatever ascetics and Brahmins who are speculators about the past or the future, because these 62 views are organized by whether they have views about the past or views about the future, having fixed views on these matters, and having put forth speculations about these matters, they are all trapped in the net of these 62 divisions. It kind of lays it out like a net, like a grid. Imagine a table, maybe. And wherever they emerge and try to get out, they are caught and helped and held in the net. Caught and held in the net. So here he's talking about the danger of certain views. That it's dangerous to be involved in stories and views. It's possible to have stories and views that we even try to get out of, but they somehow have the tentacles that keep us caught in their net. And just as a skilled fisherman or his apprentice might cover a small piece of water with fine mesh net, thinking whatever larger creatures there may be in this water, they are all trapped in the net, caught and held in the net. So it is with all these. They are all trapped and caught in the net of these views. So I don't know if it's a fair assessment. Buddha gives a fair assessment of these other people. I think that this ancient discourse has a certain kind of mythic quality to it, so created for polemic purposes. I don't know that those people couldn't respond and say, wait a minute, yeah, we're being mischaracterized. But independent of that, I think what's the important lesson here is this reframing of the focus away from the views and the stories, the doctrines, to how they're being held. And if they're held with attachment, there's danger involved in those attachments. Then maybe we're caught in the net of them. And it's possible, I know I've seen people who have realized the falsehood of one set of beliefs, and then simply replaced it with attachment to another set of beliefs. Because the momentum of attachment is so strong, and they haven't understood what motivates the attachment. The fear, the insecurity, the something. And so again, we sit quietly. Such a simple thing. We sit, meditate, sit quietly, sit, try to sit peacefully, sit patiently. And as we do that, slowly, it's a powerful, powerful thing to sit, ongoingly meditate, sit with yourself. And what will happen through this process of really being mindful and present is that what becomes important is not the views and teachings that you live by, per se, but rather what's important is the attachment, the clinging, the agitation that underlies those. And that becomes clear as you meditate. And as you meditate, those begin to relax. Or that's at least the direction the meditation is meant to take you. Relax and settle. And when you're relaxed and open and unattached, and you're able to see out into the world through the eyes of being peaceful, it's a different world than if you look out through the lens of teachings, out through the lens of, you know, metaphysical doctrines and stories and everything. So that's the first discourse, in the beginning. In the beginning, there was no attachment. So, I hope that was okay. Long little story. Don't get attached to it.